This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, happy Thursday to you, and we're back. Season 9, episode 9. Thanks for all the messages. How brilliant was Gary last week? I'd totally forgotten about the drinking the candle story until somebody put it on, our friend Georgina put it on Twitter. I don't know how I could forget that. The new people come into it. Did you go back and listen to part one and then jump straight into part two? Did you give it a bit of a break? Let me know. It'd be interesting to see how they both parts sort of fit together and if it sort of works as one full long episode. Let me know. So moving on from a chef that looks after 6 restaurants to another chef that looks after 1, but it's also where he lives. So Eddie Shepherd, let me give you some backstory. So a couple of years ago, a friend of mine got me a birthday card, and in the birthday card it had all the lovely things that you would write to somebody in a card. But they also said, oh, by the way, one of your presents is that I've managed to get as a table at Eddie Shepherd's restaurant, The Walled Garden. And it's a big old vegetarian tasting menu. But it's us and 6 other people. Because in his kitchen, he can only fit like 8 people in. I think that's right. Apologies, Eddie, if I've got that wrong, if you're listening. But I think it's around 8 people. And it's just him. He's a one-man band. He's prepping. He's cooking. He's presenting the dish. He's delivering it to the table. And it was up there with one of the greatest meals I've had out. It was such a fantastic experience. So I really wanted to sit down and talk with him about how this started, why it started, why hasn't he got a restaurant, about, you know, maintaining control of what he does. Anyway, we managed to sit down quite a long time after that meal, and it was nothing short of fantastic. He's a lovely guy to sit down and talk to. As you're going to hear, he's very calm and very relaxed for a chef. I mean, you can't imagine how stressful that is when you're in a working kitchen. But it's great. And also, he cooked me some lunch. and it was incredible, as you'll hear. Oh, big shout out to somebody who gets multiple mentions, I think, on this episode, which is Becky Morris, who is the ceramicist. If you look on the Instagram, on our Instagram, on Eddie's Instagram, or Rebecca Morris Ceramics, her Instagram feed, you'll see a lot of her stuff there. It's beautifully designed ceramics, and she's brilliant. Her Instagram's really lovely and very calming if you just want to watch the potter's wheel. It's really nice, really good stuff. So big shout out to Becky Morris, who features heavily in this episode, because she's great. And from one person who's great to another. This is season 9, episode 9 of the Two Shot Podcast with the wonderful Eddie Shepherd. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, but we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Eddie, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I mean, a lot of people who know me know that apart from the acting aside, my fascination with people is one of the reasons why I started this podcast. But
sure.
When I'm not doing this and I'm not reading a book...
Yeah.
Which is another thing that I love to do when I have the time, if I'm not looking after my little boy. I like to be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Because I'm constantly fascinated with how things work. And I've always loved restaurants and chefs. And I remember during the first lockdown, I used to find the most intricate recipe that I go, right, well, if it involves like 40 cloves of garlic, then that's an hour of my day. But we're here now, not only in your... house,
mm-hmm.
but this is your restaurant as well.
Yeah.
So I think we need to explain to people, because the first time that we met, mm-hmm. you cooked for me, not just me, there was a few other people here. And how many courses did you cook? Was it?
So probably, it's usually 12 to 14, something in that range. Like, yeah. It's a lovely way of cooking in your own space and sort of, for me, it's all my favourite bits of what I used to love about restaurants, but without a ton of the headaches.
Well, I was going to say, does having a restaurant in your own home, and it's just you.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I sat down and I was thinking, oh, well, obviously you'll have somebody cleaning down and washing up or bringing things out, but it doesn't work like that, does it? So can you just sort of explain mm-hmm. why the pressure is off? Because I was thinking the pressure might be more.
Sure. So so the way I'm cooking is just me in the kitchen. It's pretty hardcore because of that, in terms of like prep and how you manage to do service and talking to the guests as well. But once you have all your sort of systems in place, like the great thing is I know exactly what everything is up to at all times, you know. So if I go to look for like the cured mushrooms that I use or something, if they're not there, it's because I haven't made them, you know. It's like no one says, oh, that's definitely done, or it's, and just things like that give you so much control of the whole process and where you're up to.
Sure.
and creative freedom as well, that it's a really lovely way of cooking.
So there's nobody to blame, is there?
Well, only me to blame, yeah.
So let's go back. How did it come about? Because obviously you don't just go, right, I'm going to start up a restaurant in my own mm-hmm. house. Let's go back to when cooking was introduced to you. Was it from an early age?
Not really. I mean, like my parents and my grandma especially, like cooked and cooked from fresh, but it was not a... like a hobby side of thing, you know. I mean I don't want to throw them under the bus here either.
My mum, right, they'll forgive you.
Yeah, they're great cooks, but it wasn't something that was a passion in the family or anything. You know, it was they'd cook lovely meals from fresh, but we weren't going out to restaurants particularly, things like that. So it wasn't until I was at university and was working in kitchens kind of to pay my way through my degree that I sort of fell in love with, maybe even fell in love with kitchens more than cooking to start with.
Because of the atmosphere or the camaraderie?
Both of those things, yeah. The kind of subculture of it as well. The fact it's its own little world. It's a bit aside from everything else. And the energy. And that got me really hooked. And I'd been, at the time, I was doing quite an academic degree as well as doing philosophy. And then, so to then go into this environment that was like completely different from that, you know, so suddenly very like physical and energy driven rather than kind of contemplative and confusing. That got me really pretty much completely hooked and led to sort of about 15 years I was in restaurants sort of up and down the country before I started. Well, I sort of got to the point that a lot of chefs get to where you would think now is my time to do my own thing. Now is the point where it sort of makes sense for me to open something or start a project. And I didn't totally know what that was going to be. And so initially this started as, well, I'll try doing this. I'll have people into my space. I'll do these dinners. I'll test out the ideas that I'm interested in. And then kind of like, I think I've been going about 6 months into that when I was, and sort of developing it more, and it was getting more ambitious and going like, you know, more courses are getting introduced and stuff. That I got to the point where I was like, I don't think I need to do something else. Like this is everything that I really want out of cooking. And and rather than it being, at first I sort of thought, I still had in my head the idea that it's secondary to a restaurant, like it's an imitation of that experience. And then actually the more you lean into it being something different and something where, rather than it being, say, a downside that you don't have a front of house person serving people, well, the flip side of that is that I get to chat to everyone and can kind of like talk directly about stuff that I find is interesting, you know, sometimes maybe more than people want.
No, it's something that you're really good at.
Oh, good.
Because I remember a few years ago for my birthday and we went to Longclume in Cartmel. And, you know, it's not the head chef coming out and explaining the meal to you.
Sure.
It's the servers coming up and going, here we have this and this and this, enjoy. And you go,
yeah.
You come and talk directly to, like, how many people is it? Is it eight or?
Yeah, eight normally.
Yeah.
It's a nice number to kind of, it's small enough that you can sort of get to know each table. Mm. You can have a bit of time with everyone.
No, you really do. Because I remember, because you've got so much passion when you come and explain what everybody's going to eat next. And you always go, if you've got any questions, look, I'm here. Yeah. Just come and talk. And inevitably, obviously it's me. I did have loads of questions.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Like I think it works a bit like, it would, I guess, with audiences and stuff as well. Like kind of the more I get back from people, the more I can give them. You know, I think when people come with questions or they're interested in engaging, like the more that happens, the more we can kind of go into depth on stuff, the better I think it is for the atmosphere. And almost always if someone asks a question, you know, someone else in the room wants to know that same thing too,
exactly,
you know?
But also it sparks a conversation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it may be because it is such an intimate experience,
yeah,
and yeah, you're with groups of other people and you've all never met before, and you're in your kitchen and you're eating. So some people might feel slightly shy, but if somebody asks a question, then they go, oh, maybe I can ask my question then.
yeah absolutely.
But just going back to when you were starting off in kitchens, as you know, a bit like acting, when you start off you're stood at the back carrying a spear or you've got one line.
Very much like kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't it? Because you're starting off right at the bottom.
Yes.
Inevitably you're on the pot wash.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely. That was my, actually I was thinking about this earlier, because when you say it out loud, it sounds like I had quite it's quite a romantic introduction to kitchens, in that my first job would have been in this castle in Scotland, because I was studying in Stirling.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you. And I mean, like, the job itself was obviously, you know, it's what KPing is like, you know, it's just, you're just there in a dark, damp pot wash all day. But then you'd come out and you'd be stood in this, like, yeah, this beautiful castle on the top of this hill. And but yes, that's the start point for most people in kitchens. Is pretty thankless, like, pretty mucky, physically hard work. And yeah, there's a lot of that at the start. Yeah,
but it's got to be done, hasn't it? Because otherwise, if there's nothing to eat off, it's your fault.
Oh man, yeah. If you're ever, you know, if you're in a busy restaurant and the KP doesn't show up or is sick or the pot wash breaks or something like that, you realize how much that is the hub of, like, of things. And you know, suddenly you've got chefs piling in there trying to deal with it. It really makes you realize someone, like, it's a really undervalued job, because someone good at that and keeping on top of stuff, it might seem like, from the outside, I guess it seems like the lowest skilled job in the kitchen and stuff, but it is by no means not skilled, even just to be doing that.
Yeah. No, I remember when I was working in a very bustling cafe in, it was in St. Anne's, which is Blackpool. And before I was on the pot wash, I remember one of the guys showing me how to wash up properly.
Right, yeah.
He said, don't ever put those knives in there. You put your knives in there, put hands in there, yeah. You've got hands cut, that's it. You can't do your job and you're out and we're fucked.
Yeah.
And it's just about, it's a machine, isn't it? You're just churning it out. It's like being on a checkout. You've just got to keep up on it. And, you know, yeah, it does. I mean, it's terribly long hours as well.
Yeah, it definitely is. But there's a sort of weird, again, I remember at the time finding a degree of, I mean, it's easy to say this now, I'm not doing it anymore, but a degree of satisfaction in it and a sort of sense of, I don't know, it was one of those first things in the kitchen that captured me, this sense that you could go in, there was a really definite aim, like, and a really definite part that you were playing within that team. Mm. So even if it was, like, not glamorous at all, you still were sort of, you know, you felt important in that role. And going from sort of studying and everything being, especially philosophy, where there's not really any, you know, well, maybe this is arguable, there's not really any right answer to anything. You never quite know if you've really sort of achieved something. But then, you know, you knew in a restaurant kitchen, like, you knew when you were done, you knew when you had, like, completed a really busy service, and it's that buzz of adrenaline and everyone had kind of got through it to the end. And yeah.
So after KPM, what was your next step? Because then you obviously you're given more responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened to me, I mean, I wonder if this happens as much anymore, but it probably still does. Mm. But it's what happened to a lot of chefs of kind of my generation, I think, where you perhaps start in a role like that, then one day one of the chefs doesn't come in for some reason and someone's like, okay, you're on.
You've got to step up.
Yeah, you're coming into the kitchen.
That's like understudying in the theatre.
Right. I'm suddenly being thrown on.
You're suddenly being thrown. He hasn't turned up or he's sick.
Yeah.
he's got COVID, you're on.
Would that be terrifying, or would that be the thing you'd look forward to kind of having your chance?
It depends. Depends how prepped up you are.
Sure.
Very early on in my second job, I was understudying in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Right.
Regent's Park Open Air Theatre, which is a lovely venue. It's a gorgeous job, and you're doing, like, the summer season and everybody comes and has their picnics, and then they come and see a Shakespeare or two. And I was understudying for Demetrius.
Uh-huh.
I was playing one of the mechanicals. And this guy was a machine. He was solid. He ain't never going off. There's no, and I was young and stupid. I don't need to learn it. He is never going to go off. Well, there was one night.
Oh, jeez.
I don't think Chris is coming in. I mean, he's stuck. He's not going to be here. Craig, you're going to go on. I went, well, the fear.
Yeah. Eddie,
the fear. I was... It wouldn't have been any good. I was frantically looking at the text going,
sure.
Yeah, I can. No, there was no way I could have done it. And from that moment on, I mean, I never understood it again. But I thought, if I do need to understudy, my God, I will do my homework.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, that sounds like, at least, you know, at least with something like the kitchens and stuff, like, you're hidden away, right? Like, so there's a, like, God, like, I can't imagine.
But what's on the plate isn't hidden away, is it?
It's true, but then, especially when you're starting out, there should be, in theory, if everything's working properly, there should be other people that are going to, like, check that stuff
and
before
support
it goes
you.
Out. Yeah. You know, and, I mean, still now, if I have, like, anxiety dreams, it's always about, it's things like your understudy thing. It's like, you're in a restaurant, maybe a restaurant I used to work in, and they're like, oh, yeah, so we've changed the menu, and we're ready for, and you should, like, that's my, but that, even that, my worst sort of anxiety dream, you're still hidden away, kind of, you're not up there in front of people.
That's the same sort of actor's anxiety dream of just, you're walking on stage, and you're going, I have no idea what I'm talking about. I don't know this environment. I don't know this play. Yeah. And there's thousands of people in front of me waiting.
Jesus.
You wake up in a cold sweat.
Terrifying.
So did you move around kitchens sort of learning different skills and deciding what you wanted to do? Because obviously some people, it's pastry. Pastry is their thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, you know, butchery is their thing, but I suppose you've got to kind of do it all. I mean, obviously we're going to take meat out of the equation at some point, and I'm just going to work out when that was.
Well, so that was a factor early on, that I had gone vegetarian whilst I was studying, and that sort of had coincided with almost exactly, really, with actually starting as a chef in the kitchen. Like, I was already vegetarian, I think, when I was working as a KP, and then they kind of got me into the kitchen, but they knew I was veggie. They were just like, but I must have had some aptitude, or they, you know, I was good at least the KPing job. So I think at that point, no one in the kitchen worried about that. They were like, yeah, we're just a safe pair of hands is what we need. Which again is maybe really fortuitous in retrospect, because it would have been quite hard, I think, to just rock up at a restaurant in Scotland somewhere and say, I've got no experience and I'm vegetarian. Please can I come and work in your kitchen?
Yeah.
But that, yeah, they were really, I mean, largely, and my experience from then onwards was that actually most of the time in kitchens, even back sort of 15 years ago when the plant-based stuff wasn't as big, people did not care about that. If you could get your job done, that was what mattered to people. But it did sort of slightly dictate what kitchens I went to afterwards, although the first few kitchens I worked in were cooking with meat and fish and stuff.
And are you all right with, because I don't know the reasons why you just turned vegetarian, but are you all right with handling meat and fish, or is that something that you find?
Yeah, I certainly was, like, especially starting out. I mean, I like, to be honest, a lot of the jobs you would do with it, I don't think anyone would find super pleasant, like deveining shrimp and stuff like this, but
that's horrible.
Well, yeah, it's not fun.
to make money before I left Lancashire to London, I was working as an apprentice butcher.
Right.
There was some jobs there that I found particularly difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I eat pretty much everything.
but
still, for me, it's, and sometimes the smells were quite overpowering.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's, I mean, again, it's sort of hard to know, because now at the, I mean, I can't imagine being in that situation now, but at the time I was quite good at just segmenting it in my mind and was like, this is one of the work jobs, like, it's, and most of what I was doing really in those early kitchens anyway is you were cooking, you know, pieces of fish or meat to order if you were dealing with them. So a lot of that is not really to do with tasting stuff as you're cooking. It's more to do with your timings and things like that. And so that the first couple of restaurants I was in, I was doing things like that. But I would gravitate then in those restaurants towards pastry and towards that sort of stuff, because you were just, I also kind of, as much as anything, the ingredients that you're working with, but also I think that, I mean, you sort of see it on the menu now still, that sort of suits the way I think about things and look at things. I quite like the precision of that stuff. I quite like small, delicate things. And
all things in test tubes.
Yeah. I like the slightly unusual as well, when it comes to, especially with presentation and stuff. That came a lot later, but became like quite an important part to me, this sort of the aesthetics of food as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's very beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
When this little morsel of food is delivered and the taste, and you just think, I mean, you look at something and you see like three words of what the components are of this dish, and you go, I can't believe that is that. Or,
oh, good.
It is, it is incredible. But I suppose presentation is something that you're constantly working on and building on.
Yeah. I mean, it always kind of, for me at least, it always comes last because, you know, the fundamental things, I mean, fundamentally, everything's got to be delicious. And especially actually one of the real upsides of the way that I work now, the fact that everyone can see me in the kitchen whilst I'm cooking and I'm going to serve everything to everyone means that there is, that really strips away anything superfluous because I'm going to put the food right down in front of you. So if it is not, if I'm not confident that it's 100% delicious, then you're going to be, you know, I'm going to be stood there confronted by watching everyone eat everything. You know, if there was any kind of Emperor's New Clothes stuff about it, you're stood there and visually seeing it and everyone can glance up at you in the kitchen. So it's super important to me that everything is really focused on how delicious it can be.
Yeah.
And then, but then I always think, you know, after that point, that, you know, when, especially some of the effort that goes into things, like when you've put that much work in, why would you not then push that extra sort of 10% to try and then make something visually interesting or maybe make people engage with something in an interesting way as well? Because if you're having, say, 12 courses, you know, there's that can easily become, you know, you could get 6-7 courses in. And if everything's served in kind of the same way, because sort of maybe even if not at the time, but afterwards in your memory, it all sort of starts to blur together a little bit. And you can't, like, okay, everything was delicious, but I kind of couldn't necessarily pick what one dish from the next dish. And a way of kind of breaking that and resetting people a little bit is to have people interact with something in a different way. So that the little thing we have in the glass straw
the one that you just sucked down.
Yeah, oh my God.
Yeah. And it's such a shock, but it's a delightful shock as well. Oh, it just hits your mouth and hits the back of the throat and it tastes incredible.
So that, I mean, I could do that in a different way. You know, I could just give you a little tiny glass with something like that in, but that point of the menu moving from savory to sweet by having, you've got these very refreshing flavors of mint and chamomile and raspberry, but also having you interact with this in a way that, you know, most people won't have had something.
No, not at all. I mean, it looks fun. I mean,
yeah, it
looks like dangerous. It looks like a miniature glow stick. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a sort of mental reset that as much as anything else, and it gets people like okay, we're kind of into like acts two or three of this, and that stuff I think is. I get it. Well, it's one of the really enjoyable things about feeling like you're across the whole menu is that you can start to think of it in terms of that, not just like, okay, I have, these are the three dishes I prep and send out. You know, you get a real overview of like, how does that flow and how do you want to kind of, how do you want people to experience the evening as a whole?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting a bit.
No, this is amazing. So Eddie, do you think when you were taking holidays in Europe and around the world and working in restaurants, that the UK at that point was sort of playing catch up to certain pockets of the rest of the world in regards to pushing culinary boundaries forward and sort of maybe breaking taboos, if that's not too dramatic?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a little bit, I don't know if I would have had a rounded enough knowledge and view to sort of to know at that time. But I think like the Fat Duck definitely did wonders for putting the UK at that kind of cutting edge, and then, but I think people were looking towards France initially, and then Spain was such a big part of the sort of the new sort of avant-garde movement in food, and then the big Nordic food movement, that was
huge for a while.
I mean, we still, I guess, see that in it less directly now, and all of these movements kind of leave their mark on what on cuisine afterwards, but especially for the UK, I think the Nordic thing was massive because we've got kind of quite similar climate. So, you know, it's all well and good. Like when exciting stuff's happening in Spain, you're like, oh, that looks so cool. And they're doing this thing with a tomato. Well, you know, you're not going to get a great, like a tomato like you would in Spain here because in the Northwest.
The taste is completely different whenever, oh, I long to go on holiday. But when you do and you go, I'm having this tomato in Spain or in Italy and it tastes like a tomato, not like watery nothingness that we get over here.
Yeah, that's it. And to try and mimic that stuff over here is just, you know, you're really up against it if you're trying to use those sort of Mediterranean ingredients but then you know, this explosion in Nordic food and suddenly this sort of exploration of what you could do with things that would grow in regions like ours and looking at ingredients that were maybe a bit forgotten and the introduction of fermentation and stuff is none of which is a huge part of what I do, but all of this stuff has an influence on you. So all of these movements have become sort of absorbed into what I think most chefs, you know, working in the UK now would have, or in these kind of tasting menu restaurants and stuff, that you'll see influences from all of these things across their menus.
Yeah, and you do, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, there's a phase where I think we're kind of past this now, but there was a period of time where everything was on like an old earthenware plate and kind of dropped so it looked like it had been scattered and had some foraged ingredient. None of which is bad in itself, but except that if that's everything that you see, or if it's done without like real thought and intention, then of course, like anything, it's, you know, it just becomes, you know, copying what else is happening elsewhere. But
instead of pushing things forward or putting your own spin or your own take on it.
Yeah. Which we do have now, you know, now we have people doing really interesting stuff and which is cool. And being here in the Northwest, it's great to have, like, you know, we're not far from Stockport where I grew up.
Yeah.
And having like where the light gets in there.
Yeah.
It's like,
which, you know, we talk about pushing.
Yeah.
And do they have a garden on the roof, don't they?
They do. Yeah. So me and Sam, who owns Where the Light Gets In, went to school together in Stockport.
Right.
Like he was the year above me. So I've got some nice sort of childhood memories of us talking about music and stuff together, and we worked in this really crappy off license together when we were younger as well. And just knowing Sam was always like really interested in things and super charismatic and really enthusiastic and stuff. So I'm not surprised at all that he's done something so successful and interesting. But growing up in Stockport, you know, someone telling you there'd be this really like really fascinating, groundbreaking restaurant there, and where the garden is on the top of the Merseyway shopping center, like it's just all of it. So I mean, that's, it makes it so cool though as well, that you, because that completely says then, oh, you can do something interesting anywhere. You know, if you can have a garden on the top of the Merseyway shopping center, you can really, you, if you have the will and the sort of the desire to do it, you can do something cool with whatever you've got.
You know? Well, I mean, you know, just to mirror it with acting and certainly younger students that I talk to who, you know, couldn't possibly afford to live in London, I would say, you don't have to go down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last 2 years have proved that you can just be anywhere and hopefully try and graft and work and ply your trade.
Is there a version, because one of the things that the internet enabled a lot for chefs was like doing pop-ups and things like this, which, you know, again, it would happen in the past, but became much easier to sort of, you know, with Instagram and online ticketing things, suddenly you could set up, right, I'm going to do a pop-up, I'm going to get the word out to people. You know, is there an equivalent of that at all with like acting and stuff? Are people able to mobilize on a more personal scale or?
It depends. I don't know. I'm still, I have quite a love-hate relationship with social media.
Sure.
Anyway, but I mean, I tend to use it quite a lot if I'm promoting a show.
Yeah, yeah.
Because also, basically, whoever you work for like you to do it.
Yeah,
and it's not They don't tell you to do it, but they imply that would be a very nice thing to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of no skin off my nose if I go, oh, look, Doctor Who's on tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be great if
yeah.
you could watch it. I think it's dead good, but, you know, no drama if you don't.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't want to talk about the pandemic because this is a getaway from that.
Sure.
But I'm aware, certainly in my industry, how it affected many, many people. And I'm aware how it affected certain friends who I know that run restaurants.
Yes.
And who have staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've, you know, and suppliers and all that. So with you not having, quote unquote, a restaurant.
Yes.
And no staff. What was the impact for you?
So it was...
I suppose personally and as a business, if that's not too
clear. Yeah, no, I'm it was mixed, I think, like it was for an awful lot of people. I certainly was not the worst hit by everything, but also, and I didn't have some of the dilemmas that friends had with restaurants. So not having any staff, I didn't have to think, God, how am I going to, you know, especially at the very early stages before it was clear what might happen with things like furlough, you know, people were wondering, am I going to have to let staff go and stuff? And I was very grateful not to have to, you know, make horrible decisions like that. The downside of this is because of the way that I was set up, I sort of fell through the gaps of the government support. So there was just nothing there to act as a buffer for me.
Yeah.
But being small, I changed to doing takeaway. So at first I did takeaway sort of 3 days of the week. And then one day of the week, I would drive around and drop loaves off for people could like nominate someone on Instagram, like if they were NHS frontline or isolating because they were vulnerable. And I would go and drop off some food for them. And that was, I mean, that was lovely for me in that period of time because it made me feel like I was doing something useful. Although, you know,
and also being creative.
It kept me busy, kept me active. And, you know, that was, and then, I mean, it didn't take very long until fantastic people like Mary Ellen, who runs the creameries and Eat Well.
Yeah.
Like how quickly she set up this charity to feed people and to use up stock and
that
to get chefs.
That seemed to happen like overnight. And then it just really flew and took off, didn't it? Everybody was grafting and helping.
Yeah, I mean, that is, it is staggering still to me, like how she managed to set that up. And I mean, she is incredible. Like, you know, she is one of my favorite people in the world and does, you know, she does not get enough credit for how nuts that is that she did all this stuff. And, but yeah, it was definitely, I mean, it was brutal across the board, I think, for the hospitality industry. You know, and we are still seeing some of that now.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky in that I have enough of a following that people were really keen to help out. People wanted to get takeaways and stuff. People that I had 6 months worth of bookings, which is bit terrifying because people pay in advance for the meals they come and have here. So at first I was like, am I gonna have to refund everyone that's booked in?
I was one of those people.
Oh, wait, yes, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It took over a year to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you'd have been in, like, you probably should have been coming in like March or April 2020, right?
Yes.
Or something.
Yeah.
So that was, but what I mean, what was incredible was the feeling of support that I got from my guests and stuff was massive. And so virtually everyone, like 95% of people said, no, please keep our booking. We really still want to come. We'll shift it into the future. Which again is such a incredibly privileged position to be in, to know like that you've got that support. And even when I had cancellations and things sort of this time last year, as restrictions kept changing, people were so keen to come that I could quite quickly fill those, which I know has not been the case for every restaurant. And yeah, so I certainly didn't have an easy time of it, but I definitely didn't have the hardest time of it either. And it's, I particularly feel for my sort of colleagues with restaurants that had to face just a level of stress that must have been just horrible, you know, to think, how am I going to support my staff? How am I going to keep paying rent on the restaurant and stuff is, yeah, it's, you know, really, really awful stuff to have to,
yeah, of course,
face up to.
Yeah. Now, you don't have a restaurant in a lovely little suburb of Manchester or in town, because if you do, as excuse me, as a punter, you walk past there and you go, oh, that looks nice, or that looks full, so that's already free advertising for the restaurant.
Yeah.
How do you advertise? Because you don't walk past your house.
No.
It's almost a nice little secret. So,
yeah.
Was there any time, what were your sort of worries about doing everything from home? Or was there a point where you thought, I might go down the road of opening my own place?
Yeah, I mean, at first I did sort of think that when I started doing this, I think I did think, well, I'll do this for a bit. I'll sort of figure out my ideas. I didn't really know what I was going to do, but still in my head was, you know, from the early days of being in restaurants, I thought my ambition would be to have my own restaurant at some point. And then
were you thinking about using this more of like a test kitchen?
Yeah, that was sort of in my head at the start, I think, was I'll try stuff out. I'll see what works. Often sort of self-generated stuff had worked quite well for me. So I'd done some like self-published digital cookbooks and things like this. So I was kind of doing little self-generated things felt like it was sort of in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But yeah, initially I was not thinking of this as a permanent thing. And at the start it was still it was a challenge to get people to understand what you're doing and get the word out a little bit. But then, yeah, I think at sort of a year in, I was at the point where there was enough requests and demand for people to come that I sort of didn't have to worry about that really anymore.
Do you think word of mouth was a key factor in that as well?
That I think was the biggest thing. Like even with all the social media stuff that you can do these days and you know, I post food pictures and stuff online and things like that.
Very nice food pictures too.
Oh, thank you. the biggest thing I think was people coming and then they would tell their friends, like, you should go and check this out, which is really cool.
I can't describe it to you. You just have to go.
yeah. Which is, and I get loads of that now. Still, I get messages from people like coming through saying, I really want to book in. So and so, like, my mate's been here. They said, you know, I should come. And that's particularly lovely, especially when people are here and I'm chatting with them. If it's because they've been, you know, someone has really enthused about it and told them to go, that feels, you know, it feels nice to know that things can work that way without necessarily the social media side of things. And it's this direct, you know, it's this personal recommendation from someone, which I don't undervalue, because, you know, to say to someone, I love this and I think you'll love it too, you're kind of putting yourself out there a bit. Like, you know, if you said that about a film or something to a friend and they watched it and were like, I don't know what you're on about. It was terrible. Why did you send me to do this thing? You know, there's a sort of, there's almost an element of risk in recommending something, especially like really heavily recommending something to a friend. So.
But also the flip side of that is, and it's cliche, but you can't buy that publicity.
No. Which is lovely.
Yeah. It's incredible because someone's passing it on and they've put their investment into it.
Yeah.
And they're going, right, this is for you.
Yeah. Well, that might be, I wonder if that's like, that's one of the nice things about working this way is it's almost the antithesis of like, you know, big restaurant PR openings and stuff where they're like, come and see this cool thing. And like, you know, it's the total opposite end of the scale in terms of like, I mean, there's no PR and there's no...
You're not inviting frills. All the people that will talk to the people who they have to talk to.
Yeah, yeah.
To get word out in your kitchen.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's quite nice to know you can do stuff still without that these days. You know, you can, I mean, even now I'm still, even though I have this, like, this nice, I feel like I have this, this sort of well of support and people interested in coming and stuff, it's still sort of fairly under the radar in terms of like PR and articles and things like that. But again, that's kind of nice to know you can still, yeah, you can do your thing.
It's kind of cool though as well. Yeah, let's, yeah, I mean, yeah, you've got to sort of...
That's what I'm going to cling to.
Yeah, yeah, cling to that. Now, how do you deal with critics? Because when critics go to a restaurant, am I right in saying that usually they book under a pseudonym?
Yeah, well, I haven't had much in the way of... I mean, that's one of the things I would love at some point would be to get one of the big national critics here. I mean, I say get them here, like I wouldn't get them here. It'd be lovely if one of them decided to visit. But so I haven't had much on that scale of things. I've had sort of local journalists and stuff come and people from like a lot of Manchester sort of like, you know, what's on online stuff.
Yeah, but that's still keeping it within more or less the bubble of the Northwest.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, do you remember a couple of months ago when Jay Rayner went to Erst and put it in the Observer on a Sunday and it just blew up.
That's super. You know, it's so nice seeing places like that as well get that kind of recognition, because there's a ton of great restaurants up here, including people like them, and there's loads that I feel, I mean, the Northwest in general can kind of go under the radar of what's going on. So it's great to see stuff like really getting shouted about. And it feels to me at least, like there's a scene up here for this stuff. There feels like there's a bunch of places with kind of similar-ish ideals, like really, you know, trying to do interesting stuff, really committed to how delicious it is.
Yeah.
And it's like a lot of the chefs from like the restaurants all sort of know each other. So sometimes you'll go to stuff and you'll know a load of people there. There'll be a wine event or something. You'll go and you'll see like chefs from all the different restaurants and they're all like hanging out. And so, like, it's quite lovely to feel like we've got that now in the Northwest. I don't know if that was there so much before. Maybe it was and I just was not a part of it.
Do you get to go out?
Not as much as I would like. I mean, partly this past 2 years has just been, obviously everything's been closed, and then when it hasn't been, I've been sort of pedaling furiously to catch back up. And so what I would do in the past is sort of try, maybe like twice a year, try and go to something like that felt like a big experience for me, like somewhere with a star or two. Or in the past, me and my partner went across to Noma and went, I mean, that was incredible. Everything. Have you been?
No, it's been somewhere I've wanted to go for many years, but I know I feel like I would walk in there and go, oh yeah, I feel like I've been here before, because I've read and watched so many documentaries about that place, and a few friends of mine have been and obviously been rubbing my nose in it.
I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, that was incredible. That's somewhere that, again, you know, for somewhere to live up to the level of hype that places like that have, and then you get there and it still blows you away, is like, that's pretty special. And it's, so things like that I will try to do, you know, that still feels like a big special one-off for me, you know, even though it's a work.
I think restaurants like that are extra special, and I always have to go, if it is a special time, if it's a birthday, if it's an anniversary, if it's something to celebrate, because you don't eat like that all the time.
No.
You don't have 12, 14 courses of little morsels of deliciousness all the time. Sometimes you're just having a piece of fish or a stew, especially when we're in winter. It's like, I want something that's comforting. I want mashed potato.
Completely. And those experiences, I mean, things like that for me will then stay with me the rest of my life, pretty much. Like the one that particularly springs to mind for that is there's a restaurant called Fresh in the Wirral.
Right.
So this had a huge influence on me, really, because it was, I think it might have been the first restaurant that I went to that had a Michelin star. And it's, in fact, the more I talk about it, the more you'll see the influence on me.
Right, okay.
So one guy in the kitchen on his own doing 8 to 10 sort of covers a night, you know, in not in a setup like mine, but not a million miles away, but it is a, you know, it's a proper restaurant and he has front of house staff. But
how many covers are we talking?
So eight to ten covers,
right. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and just Mark in the kitchen cooking Michelin star food for as a tasting menu for people each night. And when me and my partner went there, it was just blew me away. So inventive, really, I get creative, artistic food. And to know that was like, it was such a key piece of the puzzle for me going for that meal and then being like, right, so this guy on his own in the kitchen can do this incredible, you know, meal that I'll remember for the rest of my life. It just, I don't know, again, it's like unlocking something where you're like, oh wow, I didn't know that was a possibility that it could work like that.
Yeah,
which is, I mean, that is another one that, because he's so small, it's very, very hard to get in. But if you like, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's super special and unique, and something else in the Northwest that's like a real
find.
Gem.
Wow.
Yeah.
When has things not gone to plan in front of audiences? Because I'm always interested in how you sort of pick yourself up when you're so naked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or does that all come with preparation? I mean,
well, I'm trying to think if I've had anything that's been like a real nightmare during service. Nothing springs to mind. I think like kind of, I mean, ideally, in theory, I kind of organize as much of the error out of things as possible beforehand. Like little things, it more tends to be things that are sort of slightly out of your control and probably less to do with the food side of things. I mean, this is not a particularly interesting example, but the other day the light bulb went in the bathroom down here for the guests and stuff. But because it's just me, like I've got to find another light bulb and replace it. During service.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not a nightmare and it's not like, but it's something you probably wouldn't, you know.
Well, it's a slight inconvenience when you're in the middle of.
Yeah, I don't think Simon Rogan's doing that in Longclean, right? I don't think he's nipping out.
He's got loads of people to change his light bulbs.
So. Yeah.
When you are eating out, and not necessarily in any sort of starred establishment, can you switch off and just enjoy the food? Or are you constantly thinking, oh, that would be nice if I took that element? Or are you constantly being creative?
I'm very much, I don't tend to be analytical, I don't think, or not consciously, certainly. I mean, I guess there's always like the fact that it's the lens that you see the world through. Like, I'm sure if you watch something on telly, you can enjoy it, but it must also, you must also occasionally be like, oh, they've set that shot up like this or something. Or...
Sometimes I find it difficult to switch off.
Yeah.
Especially if it's being filmed in a city that I have knowledge about.
Sure.
You know, they're turning a corner and then all of a sudden they're turning. Well, no. Because if you walk down that street and you turn left, you don't come onto that junction.
Sure.
So that's, you've taken me out of it now, and that's annoyed me.
Yeah.
Or I'm looking at parts of continuity.
Yeah.
And he's drinking a drink in one scene, and then it cuts the other person, and it cuts back. Oh, he's got a full pint, and he only had like a third of a glass.
Sure. Yeah. I guess my equivalent of that would be. Like, I mean, I love being cooked for. Like, so I'm not analytical in the sense of being like, I'm not judgmental about food when I go out. I'm just like, I'm basically thrilled to be out and that someone's cooking for me. Like, and I would always, like, my approach to someone cooking for me would be that I want to have the most sort of generous mental attitude towards it possible. Like, I'm not looking for faults in things. I'm looking for, like, you know, enjoying it and what people have done that I think is, that's really good. And you often come away from good meals as well being like, wow, that's so cool. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe I should be doing more of that stuff. And of course, you sort of mentally reset from that.
But. Yeah, I mean, I find it cool. I'm totally inspired by it. Not that I'm going to rush into the kitchen and try it something out, but I'm just going, oh, I'm constantly going, how did he do that? How did they do that? How did she do that? Because I can't imagine those flavors going together, and yet they do in that way with that texture.
Well, I get it can be just so cool, like seeing people. I mean, even outside of like any time, really, you see someone do something they're really good at. Like, I gives you this boost of creative energy coming out of it, right? Because you're just like, wow, it's great to go and experience something where someone's just really doing their thing really well. Like, it's that's really inspiring and energizing. And the one thing that I do a bit like your continuity stuff that can take me out of an experience is if I can see the kitchen or the staff in general, like if I feel like a place, like the food can be great, but if the staff look like they're not being treated great, or they're being overwhelmed, or they're like, you know, if I heard shouting in a kitchen, stuff like that would really pull me out. Cause I just think there's just absolutely no place for that. It's just a, you know, and the idea that someone could be having an unpleasant time, like whilst they're creating this experience for you, that would completely pull me out of something and be, you know, I hope the industry is getting tons better for that stuff. And my friends with restaurants are not those sorts of people. No. So I know that it's like, it doesn't have to be like that, but that's the thing where if I felt like, this looks like somewhere you wouldn't want to work or wouldn't want to be. And it's weird that, I mean, people are more and more aware of this these days, but it's still odd to me that, you know, we've had things like, maybe this is a terrible analogy, but you know, like you would expect your eggs to be free range and stuff like this. These, you know, like there's minimum standards you would expect in terms of produce, but weirdly, not like treatment of staff and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, you could go to a great restaurant and, but if the staff are being bullied in the kitchen, like, well, in my mind, then that is not a great restaurant. That is a failed restaurant.
I mean, it was something that I wanted to come on to anyway, because when you were hopping about and working in lots of different restaurants, did you see that? Because sometimes, I'm going back in my mind a few years to sort of old school Marco days where everything was like, I had this matriarch and it's like a bully and there's a lot of shouting. Mm. Did you witness any of that when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. Again, I definitely never saw the worst end of that stuff. Some of the stories that you hear, like from other people and speaking to other chefs are really grim. You know, I've spoken to chef friends that have been like, you know, punched or headbutted or something in the kitchen. Like really, you know, real, like, I mean, abuse. Like,
so not like, verbal, it's physical.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. Like, which very luckily I never encountered, you know, but you would see pans get thrown or bins get kicked and, you know, and a lot of shouting and belittling of people, which are like, you know, is awful and can be very damaging just because it's not physical. Like, you know, if someone's like screaming at someone, especially if there's this hierarchy of this hierarchy and they're screaming at someone sort of lower down that doesn't really have any power to respond and stuff, or even if they're not necessarily screaming at them, just making their life difficult and just pushing horrible tasks towards them, just kind of taking either some pleasure or venting by like making someone else's life difficult. You know, you would see stuff like that. I'm really hopeful that the culinary world is a lot better than it was on that stuff. I mean, I've been out of those environments for a fair while now. So, but the impression that I get is that things are getting better and are broadly a lot better than they were, but that it's still not something that's been eradicated. So that is something I hope we will see completely eradicated.
Yeah. I mean, and speaking of, you know, things progressing and getting better, because when people think of a kitchen, they do think of it as quite a male heavy dominated place.
Mm.
But obviously we've spoken about Mary Ellen the big heavy hitters like Mary Ellen, Angela Hartnett, Claire Smythe. There's more. Do you know, obviously, as you say, you've been out of that environment. Is it getting better? Why are we seeing a larger ratio of men in this environment?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is getting better. I now looking at friends' kitchens, I see more women in the kitchens, which I think is great, you know, in terms of, obviously in terms of equality and stuff, yeah, as well. But I also think it's, you know, it's just good not to have these testosterone fueled, like male heavy environments. Like, I don't think that maybe doesn't even make for a good environment, even if it's well managed, for it to just be all blokes in this hot little room. I think there's still a lot of work to be done though in unpicking, like, you know, decades and decades of it, sort of the industry kind of reveling in this image of being like pressure driven,
yeah,
and, you know, the sort of the cliches of like Ramsay swearing at people on the, you know, that, but again, that definitely is changing and has changed, and you are seeing really, really talented women. I mean, you always had really talented women in kitchens, but it's nice to see like more and more women going into the industry. I think, you know, role models help as well with, yeah, this stuff. Like, you know, can you see people in, can you look at the top people and say, oh yeah, cool, I want to be like this person. That person's an inspiration to me. And as we get more fantastic inspirational women coming through, you've got more of that, you know, that visual point that you can say, that's what I want to do. I can imagine a version of that career. And I hope that we see loads more of that, although I think the industry as a whole is having real problems getting people in, you know, in the first place at the moment.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure
that could be part of the opportunity for a reset on a lot of this, yeah, stuff, you know. Fingers crossed.
Well, yeah, so, you know, from the outset, I don't have enough knowledge, but from what I see, I would hope it's, you know, it continues to progress. Mm.
I think it will. I mean, people are just so much more aware of, like, the dining public so much more educated now than ever before, and, you know, everyone's got their cameras and their smartphones and stuff on them. And just in terms of staff, like, you want to, people, you know, if you want to keep your staff, like, you have to treat them not horribly.
Yeah.
So hopefully that will have a lasting impact on how people work.
Now, where we are now with your food and your menus, mm-hmm, and you say you're pushing out all these courses overnight, and it's a long night, let's make no bones about it,
but yeah, about 4 hours,
yeah, but you have little breaks, but nothing major, you're not like waiting a long time, it's like there's always something coming along.
Yeah,
you can't do that every night, surely?
No, so at the moment what I do is I do 4 nights of the week, and I do that 3 weeks of the month, and then I have a week off where I kind of reset, and you know, that week is not really a week off. You're doing prep and you're making the things that will sort of keep through the month, so maybe that's chocolates or different infusions and cordials or distillations, like making the gin that I make, yeah, here and stuff like that. And but that's quite, so I mean, it's a ton of hours anyway that you look at it, but I'm in my own space, and that week where you're not doing service is sort of, you know, you can completely dictate how you work, what hours you work, you know, how you get the stuff done you want to do. And what that did for me is remove massive layers of stress that you would have in a kitchen typically. So it's not without stress, but
no,
but comparatively it's a different world completely, you know. It's just, yeah, game changer for me, really.
Do you think this is it for you now? Do you think this is the style, and whether you stay here but you take this model forward somewhere else, do you think this is it for you? If you can't see yourself ever opening up?
Not as things stand. I mean, like, of course, some, like, you know, something could change in life and your needs and stuff could change, but as it stands, exactly what you're saying is what I think, which is I would keep doing this, and the only change I would make to this is maybe at some point, maybe I would look for a space that allowed me to put one more table in, or expand, not necessarily even expand actually, but just I think one day it'd be lovely to move just slightly further out into the countryside and have a bit more space to, like, know, I've got beehives in the garden. It'd be nice to have some more raised beds and stuff like that. But fundamentally to do the same thing, cooking on my own, you know, doing that same sort of tasting menu. The other thing I would like to do at some stage is maybe scale up the gin. The minute I have a license to distill it, and so I can serve it to my guests, but not, you know, it's a lot of red tape to get to the point that you can sell it. And
now, you did mention there, Eddie, the bees.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
how self-sufficient are you? And is that something that's going to grow?
So I would be lying if I said I was self-sufficient here. Like, unfortunately, I mean, partly the weather of the Northwest would makes that very challenging. But
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I mean, it's looking pretty great out there today.
So, yeah.
Things like that really more for me are about, so for instance, with honey, all the honey that I use on the menu is from our bees. So that's lovely. And anything, you know, I like having elements that are grown here, or, and everything I can make in house is made in house. So again, the gin's a good example of that, sort of, you know, if you're going to that effort of distilling your own gin and then making your own tonic as the mixer for that. And that's just a little welcome drink. It sort of, it gives a sense of that's the attitude throughout the rest of the meal. But yeah, I would always love to expand on that, because I think it helps to give you a sense of place, like, you know, and it's for me as much as for the meals, it keeps me engaged and passionate about what I'm doing. So if I'm working on a dish with honey in it, like, I think I'm definitely going to be more engaged with that and passionate about it when it's from our own bees and I've spent all year caring for them. And it's, you know, how that ingredient's really important to me, and kind of, and I feel connected to it. So yeah. I'm going to want to work on something that feels really special and shares how special that is. And then when I'm chatting to the guests then as well, like, that's one of the things that I want to communicate, and I think keeps it sort of legitimately, you're sharing your passion. Like, I am, when I'm chatting to people, I am genuinely really passionate about that stuff.
I'm really excited.
Totally. That's exactly it. I'm genuinely I'm thrilled to have this chance to talk to you about my bees, about the honey, you know, about like what I think is interesting and important about that stuff. And passion, I think, really.
Yeah.
That's where
it's like anything, you know, when we're creative, if the passion goes, then we have to start asking some questions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if everything was just stuff that I was ordering in, and of course I have to order ingredients in, but if it was just, you know, I've been in kitchens again where the food's been really good, but if, you know, everything comes in through this back entrance and you just see it, you know, kind of in its packaged form as it arrives and it gets turned into the dish that goes out, and you can still do great food that way. But for me, I definitely get something extra out of the experience of, I mean, also, this is, cooking's not just my vocation and career and stuff. It really is the thing that I'm like passionate about and the lens that I sort of see the world through. So if I travel somewhere, like, a big part of how I engage with that place is going to be through food, or maybe meeting other chefs, or going, you know, and this change of the seasons, a big part of how I experience that is, okay, this, you know, dandelions are starting to come out and I know I'm going to make this dandelion petal cordial, and the start of spring for me is going out and, you know, foraging dandelions for that. It's part of the rhythm of my days and weeks and seasons and stuff. So
it all sounds beautifully romantic. I think when you put it like that, I must admit. Do you change seasonally then your menus, or how often?
Not really. So what I tend to do is change like a dish or two at a time, but very, very gradually.
You don't do a complete overhaul?
No. Even changing one dish on the menu basically sends me into.
Oh, does it?
I tend to think I will always be working on new stuff, and then hopefully once it's ready, it comes onto the menu. And there'll always be seasonal elements, and there are seasonal changes, but not like an autumn menu and then a spring menu. And some of the things that I'll make, like that dandelion petal cordial, I'll make that and then I'll make enough of that to last me through the year. So it's a sort of seasonal job and a seasonal flavor. But because I'm such so small scale, I can do something like that and then be like, great, that will take me through till this next spring. And so in fact, we'll taste in a little bit these little dandelion petal fruit pastels, which I don't think you had last time.
I don't think so.
But yeah, that's part of how I sort of engage with it and think about the year passing. And
how do you know when a dish is complete? Like, do you, because it's one thing you taste in it. Do you have somebody else to come in and trial it for you?
Yeah, so I have.
I'm not asking for a job.
Well, you're welcome anytime. Yeah. Well, so my partner Eve, she's fantastic. She's not a chef. She doesn't work in food, but she is a lovely combination of very honest and but not brutal. So, I mean, she will tell me if I'm working on something and, you know, sometimes you go over something and over something, you can get to a point where you're like, I'm sort of losing sight of, like, I no longer, my judgment is getting weird on you know, and that's, then it's really good to have someone else to say, what do you think of this? Is this getting better? Is it like, is this a good idea? Should I abandon this or keep pushing it? And so she'll always give me really useful feedback. And then there comes a point where you have to try something on the menu. And normally, so I will test things a lot before they even get tried on the menu. So I really want to serve something at the point where I'm like, I don't think this can be improved on. I think it's as good as it's going to get. I think it's ready for people. But even then, there's certain things that you only learn by serving it a couple of times, like what aspects of an idea people find interesting and engage with, you know, and what they don't. Like what's so that might not change the dish, but it might change how you talk to people about it and how, you know, maybe something that I think is really interesting is too chefy and niche, you know. So right. It's like there's no point telling people, oh, I've done this, this and this to it. How clever of me, you know, that might just not be interesting to people. And it's funny the things that you see that chime, and that will sort of alter how I choose to describe something to people, and then sometimes there are then just little tweaks that you need to make, but normally by the time I serve stuff, I've for most things I have service pieces that have been made specifically for a dish, which is another reason it's quite slow to turn over new dishes. Yeah. I'll work on a dish and then perhaps like the particular way that I want to serve it will then come together and I might have to get something made. But like our friend Becky's incredible.
Oh, her ceramics are amazing. Yeah.
Well, she's a great example of this. So the distilled Scotch bonnet chocolates that I serve at the end of the meal,
yeah,
in these black porcelain rings.
Oh, they're incredible.
They're so cool, right? Like, and that was one of my favorite like examples of working on something, because I was speaking to her and I had some vague ideas, but not really. And we were chatting and she came up with this idea of this porcelain ring, with this sort of negative space in the middle of it, and gave me one of these as a sort of prototype to play about with. And so while she was working on making the next sort of the batch of them, I was working on the dish and figuring out how that was going to fit into there and how I'd serve it. And she had this really nice like parallel creative experience of both working on this thing, which is like, is love. I love when stuff like that happens, because it's, again, it's really re-energizing, and you end up with something like quite unique. And someone like Becky's amazing.
And such a collaborative partnership though, because you didn't really know what you wanted, but then she went, well, what about this? And it's like, then this piece comes together. We must take a photo so people can understand, because it's quite hard to explain what it is.
Yes.
that Becky did. Just going back before, when you were talking about explaining the dishes and how things were cooked, that's the one thing you don't come across. You never come across as cocky or self-congratulatory at all. It's what we spoke about before. You come across excited and with such passion, and you really just I really hope you enjoy it type of thing. And yeah, it's such a joy. And I think I remember looking at around the dining room and everybody just had a big old smile on their face. Oh, that was before they started eating. So look, speaking of food, I think we should start having a look.
Let's do it.
Okay, well, I'll do some videos. So, Eddie, we are back. We've been very polite with the audience. And they don't have to witness us chomping and slurping. But let's just have a quick talk about what we've just eaten, because it was incredibly delicious.
Oh, thank you. So we had the dandelion petal fruit pastels. So we spoke a bit about the dandelion petal infusion before, and this is just a nice little thing to sort of to welcome people into the meal. It's the first edible thing they get alongside the gin and
really
tonic.
Sort of wakes up the mouth, because there's that initial sweetness.
Yeah.
And then when you start biting into this soft yellow ball, there's a nice bit of sourness as well. Yeah. So it's just waking the palate up. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Part of that idea is this sort of physical sort of waking up your palate and refreshing sort of nature of it, and then also the sort of the mental side of that, like, you know, getting people sort of primed for what else is going to come and kind of getting them into the feel of the menu and the rest of the meal.
But it's like what we were talking about before, that things like that at the start really set the tone of what the sort of, you know, without being wanky, the sort of the journey of the night of what's going to happen. And then people listening will see photos and videos of the lovely little bowl of deliciousness that we just had. So just explain to me that lovely, I'm going to call it a soup, because when I think of soup, I just think of a tin of Heinz chicken soup when you're ill.
Sure.
But no, this is another level.
So we had a roasted pumpkin soup, but it's made with this pine needle stock and then finished with a pine needle oil. So you get this sort of quite subtle, sort of more the aromas rather than the flavors of pine through that. Just like the idea is it's sort of just conjuring a little hint of the idea of a pine forest. And then the soup gets finished with this whipped cream that's smoked over burning pine branches. So you get a smokiness, a bit more pine flavor. I freeze that in liquid nitrogen and then sprinkle it over the soup at the table, so the guests get this visual kind of liquid nitrogen steam coming off the soup. Hopefully that's kind of, this starts to sound pretentious, but kind of mirroring the sort of the flavor of the smoke in the cream. So you get a kind of sort of visual cue to some of the flavors in there. But even if that it sort of doesn't transpire, you've got this nice smoke flavor and this temperature contrast.
And that pine sensation, also that kick of the black pepper is really creeps in on you, because it only came to me about sort of six spoons in.
Yeah.
I mean, I could eat that all day long. Now, before we were talking about your collaboration with Becky, the ceramicist, Becky Morris, about these circular discs. And just before we sign off and eat one, much to the jealousy of all the listeners, just explain to me what is in there.
Yeah, so it's a cool thing to end on, because it's the last thing I would give my guests as well at the end of the menu. And it's this little chocolate truffle. It's made with, flavoured with distilled Scotch bonnet chilies though. So I take a kilo of fresh Scotch bonnet chilies and blend that into 500 ml of alcohol. So we're talking about a really intensely chilly mixture. And then using the vacuum distiller that we sort of touched on a little before, I distill that mixture, but because of the way the vacuum distiller works, I can distill it at low temperature. So I can distill that mix without ever heating it up. So I keep all the freshness of the aromas of the chilies, all the sort of the vibrancy and the delicate freshness of the chilies that you'd get if you were just cutting into a fresh chili. Mm. So all those aromas stay intact, but capsaicin that makes chilies spicy is too heavy to distill. So all the spice stays on one side of the still and all the beautiful aromatics travel to the other side. And I end up with this kind of edible perfume of chilies with all the aromas, all the sort of beautiful, delicate aromatics of chilies, but with no spice, no heat to it at all. And then I flavor these chocolate truffles with that. I use a really nice double fermented chocolate from Valrhona. It's fermented with passion fruit pulp as part of the process of making it as well, which again is slightly unusual, very, very, very delicious chocolate. And then on either side of that, we've got these sort of dried crisp sheets of fermented passion fruit juice. And I get my guests to kind of pick this up out of this beautiful ceramic cylinder that that Becky's made and eat it with their fingers. And it's a little, you know, really it's just a one bite thing, but hopefully it's a really unique, interesting end to the meal. And yeah,
well, it's a unique and interesting end to this podcast. Eddie Shepherd, you had me at double fermented. Thank you so much for coming on. Let's dive into this chocolate.
Excellent. Let's do it.
Thanks so much, mate.
Cheers.
And another episode is done. How lovely was that? He's such a nice guy to sit down and talk to. I really hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, go check out Eddie's Instagram feed and look at all his fabulous creations. And if you're in the north, or if you're not, if you're planning on coming, see if you can get a table. He's not sponsoring the podcast. He doesn't need it. He's booked up to the hill. He doesn't need me shouting him out. But it really is. It really is a special meal from a lovely man. So thank you so much for downloading and subscribing and being here. Same time next week? Okay, great. In the meantime, if you would like to give us a review on Apple, you do that. That'd be really nice. Drop us an email, twoshotpod@gmail.com. Sling us a message over on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Say hello. Say hello to other people. That's always nice. We've got a lovely community of kind and considerate people who do tend to talk about the episodes, which is great. And sometimes me and Griff jump on and say hello. So that would be lovely. Anything else? I don't think so. Well, look, you take care of yourself. Have a lovely, lovely week. And I'll see you next Thursday. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Season 9. Season 9, I've got to keep reminding myself. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.